You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Since China began to inflict higher tariffs on American farmers in response to tariffs put in place by President Donald Trump, farmers have been struggling to pay back loans. A key government program shows the highest default rate in at least 9 years. Many agricultural loans come due at around January 1st, in part to give producers enough time to sell crops and livestock and to give them more flexibility in timing interest payments for tax filing. While the federal government shut down and delayed reporting, January figures showed an overall increase in delinquencies for those producers with direct loans from the Ag Department's Farm Service Agency. Alan Featherstone is the head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Kansas State University. Featherstone says the tariffs are just one factor that's hurting farmers right now.
In some respects, I think probably the bigger factor is we've just had from a global perspective, 3 or 4 good production years in a row. And so we're actually building stocks of commodity. Certainly the tariff situation didn't help on top of building stocks. But the weather has been pretty good globally, although this year we're actually seeing that, for example, Australia, they're having trouble with droughts, and so that may be changing. But certainly the production has been one of the big things that has driven it down, and then with the tariffs on top of that.
Well, looking at that delinquency rate, from what I've read, it was went from 16.5 to 19.4% of FSA loans that were delinquent in January compared to last year. That seems like a pretty big hike.
Yeah, no, it certainly is a fairly big hike with regards to more farmers in trouble. Probably the big thing that's going on is we're having a number of farms that have had negative year after negative year after negative year, and so that begins to compound, and at some point they've used up their ability to make payments for the loans that they've had.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, looking back at the 1980s, which was really a terrible time for this, it seemed like it was different then, though, because the land prices were so depressed compared to now. Does that make a difference?
That makes a large difference in terms of, given the income situation, if we had rapidly declining land values, we would be in a very difficult situation right now. Again, it's still not a good situation, but the fact that land values have held up have really allowed a number of producers to make adjustments and have kind of just allowed them to come through. Probably the other big difference is the interest rates. If you look at the interest rates now compared to 13, 14, 15% for operating lines that you had in the 1980s, that makes a big difference. So far, the interest rates have remained fairly favorable to farmers. They have crept up a little bit in the last week or last year or two, but again, we're in a relatively much better position on interest rates and land values than we were in the 1980s.
Are banks requiring more collateral or just collateral in general in ways they didn't before?
Certainly, they've increased the collateral requirements over the last 4 or 5 years. But in some respects, the collateral requirements actually were tightened in the good years. And so I think that's helped a number of producers that didn't get so far out on leveraging new acquisition of land. But the collateral positions have tightened a little bit, just requiring more equity per dollar they lend.
So if President Trump were able to broker some kind of deal and end this tariff situation in the next month or so, if he goes back there and irons something out, would it make a difference then? Would it sort of fix a lot of these financial problems?
I don't know that it would fix it, but certainly it would lessen them in terms of, and that's kind of where it's kind of a two-prong type thing. We're still in a situation where there's a lot of stocks that have been built up with regards to corn and soybeans and wheat. And so obviously being able to have those move and being consumed in China and elsewhere where maybe trade has been disruptive would be positive. But even before the tariff situation that kind of has arose in the last year, there would be a number of producers that still would have negative incomes.
So it's been something that a lot of things that are contributing, and it's probably been sort of building up over a few years is what you're saying.
Yeah, just and again, I don't have the 2018 numbers from our Kansas Farm Management Association in yet, but in terms of 4% of the farms that are in that database, Kansas Farm Management Association had negative income for the last 4 years. And so each year they had negative income. If you look at the last 3 years, there's 11% of the farms that had negative income in 15, 16, and 17. And then for 16 and 17, roughly 16% have had negative incomes those 2 years. But there is a converse to that in terms of there's also been a number of farms that had positive net farm incomes each of those years. And so there certainly is a lower tail, those that are struggling, and then there's those that are doing okay with the positive income. And so a lot of that's just based upon the yield that they've been able to generate on their own farm.
Does it make a difference if a farmer diversifies, if they, you know, grow some grain, maybe have some hogs or some beef, or they do milk or this or that? Do you think that makes it easier?
Maybe a little bit, but a lot of that diversification has just went away over the last 10, 15 years in terms of there's a lot that specializes on the crop side. There's some that specialize on the livestock side. And the diversified farm, if you look at the numbers we've observed in Kansas, there's just less and less that do that. There's certainly been some interest in terms of going back and maybe bringing livestock back on to some of those farms that let the livestock go. But a lot of times some of that infrastructure is wore down that there certainly is an investment cost needed to even bring livestock back on to some operations.
Economically, it's probably just a smarter move in a lot of ways to just specialize in one area.
That's what's been going on in the sector in terms of there's just been a lot more specialization going on. Probably one of the things I think that is I think somewhat important is farmers are beginning to take some cost of production out. And so they have been able to begin to reduce some of the costs.
That was Alan Featherstone, the head of the Department of Agricultural Economics at Kansas State University. Featherstone says the farm economy is still struggling more than a year after President Donald Trump put in place new tariffs on Chinese imports, and the Chinese hit back with tariffs on American commodities like corn and soybeans. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The University of Iowa Labor Center has a future after all. The center was supposed to close in June, but it looks like the center will survive after a vote last week by the Board of Regents. The center serves as a hub for labor law research. It was one of seven UI centers set to be closed to make up for what was called a generational disinvestment in the state. The Board of Regents voted to close the center first last November, but Iowa labor unions criticized the move, and supporters from around the state came out to support the center. Regents reversed their earlier decision after UI administrators and Labor Center staff created a plan to make the center self-supporting. Labor Center Director Jen Shearer says Iowans supported the center and its work, and that made a big difference in its future.
You know, there were many months of folks coming forward and speaking about their experience with the Labor Center and its impact in their local communities around the state. There were students and faculty who felt compelled to weigh in with administrators and make sure that everybody had, you know, a full set of facts and information to work with in terms of what the center's reach had been across the state, and also the research and education that were important to current students and faculty here on campus. And I think once that started to happen, there was a much fuller dialogue that happened between us and various administrators on campus. And, you know, it was a very long process. But in the end, we came up with an agreement that everybody's very committed to. And I'm really excited for the center to move forward.
And so the center will remain at the law school, correct?
That's correct.
And the funding, you're going to get funding from some alternative sources?
So what we came up with was a short-term set of commitments, several ingredients, both that we were able to bring forward with partners to add into the budget, and a serious commitment from the law school in the short term to contribute some supplemental funding, and a plan to build on various kinds of revenue streams over the next 4 or 5 years. So it's a short-term solution that really opens up the time to consider a whole range of other options.
Do you think that all of the people that came to the support meetings, that were some in Iowa City and some in other places, people coming forward and talked about how important the Labor Center was, people from across the state, do you think that really played into this decision?
Yeah, I think it's clear that it did. I mean, I think we started out with us and everybody else hearing an announcement that nobody expected. And, you know, there are a number of ways to respond to that. You know, one is to, you know, despair that you've just heard some more bad news. But in the case of this particular center, you know, it's been here 68 years. It has had a tremendous impact on people's livelihoods and careers and communities. And I think people felt both very attached to this part of the university and this part of the region system, and felt that it was worth an effort to try to come up with a better outcome.
I know that the Labor Center teaches thousands of people each year in various places around the state. What are maybe a couple of things that the Labor Center has done that you feel have been particularly helpful to working Iowans?
Yeah, I think we heard a lot of people come forward and talk about how in their particular occupations, having the ability and the tools to speak up about health and safety hazards is a life-changing impact of this kind of education that we do. I think we also heard a lot of people come forward and say that going through Labor Center courses really helped develop their leadership skills and give them a voice in shaping the conditions of their work and turning their workplaces into more fair and equitable conditions. And we heard a lot of women, I think, come forward and talk about finding their voice in the workplace as leaders because of their opportunity to access labor education. So I think those are a few of the examples. And one of the things we're very excited about, for example, is that we are the hosts of the Midwest School for Women Workers this summer. And many people are looking forward to that program. And I think one of the reasons people were so ready to speak up in this situation was that they had a lot at stake in terms of future education and wanting their children and their younger coworkers to have access to these same resources going forward.
This Midwest School for Women Workers, are these workers from all different areas of the spectrum? Who are the people that will be there?
Yeah, it's a regional program, and so it draws from usually 10 or 12 different states and people across the occupational spectrum. So everybody from, in some cases, people who are in professions like social work and education and healthcare, to people who are in the building trades, manufacturing workers, utility workers. So it really is an opportunity for people to learn about each other's experiences, and develop a lot of leadership skills and confidence to take back to their workplaces. I mean, I think one thing that was very clear throughout this process is how proud people are of their public universities. And how over multiple generations, I think they feel some significant ownership of them. And part of why people have been very excited about the news over the last couple weeks, I think, is that they're really feeling heartened that their voices were heard, and that an institution that they really love and care about and have committed to and invested in various ways is going to maintain a program that's very important to Iowans.
That was University of Iowa Labor Center Director Jennifer Shearer talking about the news that the center will remain open after being threatened with closure due to state budget cuts. The center is located at the UI School of Law. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. It looks like a bill that would have made it more difficult to create new public land in Iowa is not moving on to a committee hearing. House Bill 542 would have prevented state money from being used to acquire land for public use. The bill would also have ended the state's conservation tax credit. Joe Jajak is with the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. He testified at the hearing this week and said hundreds of people showed up at the Capitol to show their support for land conservation.
Well, it was a powerful moment. There were hunters and fishermen and farmers and bicyclists and people with little kids there. And it was, we heard comments from multiple legislators that said this is the most they've heard from their constituents on one issue over a weekend in their time in the legislature. And so it's something that people are really passionate about. We are glad that House File 542 was not moved to the full committee. We're hoping it just dies in the legislative funnel this week. If it's not moved this week, then it's dead. And that's promising. I think we have to remain vigilant that pieces of this don't show up attached to other bills later in session. So that was good to hear, and it was a powerful moment up at the Capitol. There's another bill moving through the Senate right now that has big implications on conservation that also had a hearing this morning that did move. So I think we have to some work to do on that one still. But it was a great turnout by people that love public land, that love the outdoors in Iowa, and I think our legislators got the message.
Were they impressed by what people said about the effect on the land? Were they impressed about some of the comments? I know I've read about how it could affect water quality.
Definitely, yeah. I think so. And I think that they understand public land has multiple benefits. You know, it has public health, economic development, water quality. All these things are multiple benefits of almost any public land project that these conservation organizations are doing. And I think that got through. I think the issue on the Senate bill is they're trying to do away with acquisition of public land using a state revolving fund. And so it gets a little wonky, but it's a really good water quality program that they're trying to do away with. And it doesn't really make any sense to take tools out of our toolboxes when we're doing everything we can to improve water quality in Iowa right now. So I hope that the Senate can continue to hear that message from people.
I know part of this bill and the people that were supporting it said that they would rather see money spent on land that's already been acquired that wasn't being invested in up until this point. And critics of that view said that, in fact, Iowa as a state, you know, we really don't have that much land set aside.
Right. You know, we have 36 million acres in Iowa, and around 2% of that is public land right now. And our ranking changes every once in a while. We'll move up or down a rank, but we're between 47th and 49th in the country in the amount of public land that's open to its residents. And the idea that there's too much public land is, you know, a tough one to swallow when there's obviously a lot of demand for it. And I wholeheartedly agree that we should be investing in our existing parks and recreation facilities and trails and wildlife areas. And we continually encourage our legislators to fund the DNR in ways that would allow them to do that. But, you know, over the last 10 years, funding state appropriations for the DNR have been cut in half. So I think we can continue to support what we have, but it's a little short-sighted to say that we cannot look at ways to expand parks and trails and wildlife areas when these are real economic drivers, especially for small and rural communities. And we're trying to find ways to get people to want to stay in Iowa to live and work and raise a family. And at the top of the list of things they're looking for are outdoor recreation opportunities. And I don't think we should limit ourselves in what we can do to build on those.
Could I ask you what the other bill that is in the Senate says?
Yeah, it's a lot narrower. And so that bill was trying to eliminate the charitable contribution for conservation tax credit that's used by private landowners when they donate land or land value for conservation purposes. And it was also trying to eliminate the use of the state revolving fund for public land acquisition. And that is the state revolving fund. It's mostly federal dollars, some state dollars, that are used to provide low interest loans for water quality projects. Private landowners use it a lot for infield and edge of field practices. Cities use it for stormwater treatment and things like that. And this particular pot of money, part of it was used for land acquisition that would go toward water quality projects. What that means, it's usually landowners that live in floodplains. Very often it's farmers that are looking for ways to get out of the land they own because it's flooded 3 of the last 5 years, and you know, they want to get something out of it, or they want to see it go into conservation. And so Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation is sometimes able to step in and use these low-interest loans and hold the land until it can be transferred to a public agency, either a county conservation board or the DNR. And these are really successful water quality projects that are, you know, restoring some of these places, and they have benefits because they can become public hunting areas, public hiking areas, and areas that are filtering the water before it gets into what becomes drinking water downstream for a lot of places. They also have floodwater retention benefits when you do a lot of the natural restorations like oxbows and wetland restoration. This is going to give more capacity to hold water during these major flood events that are becoming more and more common. And so we've seen results, especially along the Cedar River, where it's holding back what could have been bad flooding down in Cedar Rapids because of work that's been done up in the Cedar River watershed. So it's a really successful program, and we hope that we can continue to use it.
But I bet you're feeling pretty good about what happened today and all the people that came out.
We are. It was really powerful to see all those people there, and they were really passionate about why they were there, you know, whether it was public land or just protection of the outdoors and the environment. It felt great, and we were happy with how things went with the House bill. And like I said, I think people need to remain vigilant that pieces of this don't show up, you know, in a standings bill at the end of session when it's not going to be transparent and we have an opportunity to discuss it. But I think that it does feel good.
That was Joe Jajak of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation talking about a bill aimed at limiting public land acquisition in the state. That bill, House File 452, was stalled by a House committee on Monday after dozens of Iowans showed up at the hearing opposing that bill. The Iowa Farm Bureau had said the bill was necessary to prevent state and local governments and private entities such as the Natural Heritage Foundation and sportsmen's groups from buying land sought by farmers. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A bill in the state legislature that would allow utility companies to charge an additional fee to customers who use solar panels has now advanced out of an Iowa House committee. Republican Representative Gary Moore of Bettendorf says non-solar customers are subsidizing the use of the utility infrastructure by Iowans with solar panels.
The idea is basically if you use it, you pay for it. If you use the energy grid, either buying utility power from the utility company or sending it back to the utility from solar energy, you pay for use of the grid.
However, solar panel distributors like Van Meter Electrical Supply in Sioux City and Webster City disagree. Logan Welch is a renewable energy product manager and solar specialist for Van Meter, and he has been lobbying against that bill.
And they're trying to say it's a fair for all tax. And essentially, our stance, I serve on the ICETA board, Iowa Solar Energy Trade Association. Our stance is it's really kind of discriminatory towards solar customers, charging them an extra fee just because they're not buying the power that they offer to the fullest extent they could. You know, they're offsetting their own. So I don't really know legally all the details. I rely heavily on my lobbyists and them telling me kind of what these wordage statements mean and how it would affect us and affect our industry. But it's not good. We're definitely fighting it, and it looks like I might make it to the Senate floor for a vote.
From what I've read, seems like there's a lot of lobbying on the other side too, and it does seem like it's pretty effective.
Yeah, we think it might go through. You know, we're preparing for the worst. Let's put it that way.
How big would the effect be, do you think?
You know, we could see it be in the hundreds of dollars a year to residential solar customers, to the point where their returns on investment may be, you know, 10 to 20% longer than without it. You know, so that could deter people from going down the path of solar energy. It'll affect, you know, the job creation the solar industry's created over the last 4 or 5 years. It'll affect a lot of small businesses, primarily, you know, solar installers, but also small businesses just looking to offset some of their energy usage or save some money on that side of their business expense, the bottom line, because, again, it's going to be more expensive now to go solar than before. You know, any way you slice this, it's just another way for Mid-America to try to get the kilowatt hours they're losing to distributed generation and, you know, customers doing your own generation through renewable means back. And it's frustrating to us. And we know they're looking at, you know, the cost of that energy and that cost of maintaining the lines without the kilowatt hours from solar and customers. And compared to what they do business-wise, it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent. But we don't really know why they're picking this fight with us. It seems like every year we're at the Capitol trying to keep them at bay. But this one probably has the most teeth to it, the most legs within the Senate that it might go through.
They talk a lot about alternative energy and how much they're investing in alternative energy.
They'll put up wind and solar farms, but when their customers want to do the same, they're like, no. And if you do, we'll charge you more for your power through, you know, fancy base rates or whatever they want to call it, you know, fair for all type rates. What's fair for all is just letting people do what they'd like to create their own power with them on it. And in a way that'll actually strengthen their grid. So the more distributed generation that there is out there, the less maintenance they have to do. And when, say, your house had solar on it and you overproduced those overproduced kilowatt hours, MidAmerica could just turn around and sell to their neighbor with little or no distribution wear and tear on their lines, because they're selling it to somebody 100 feet away instead of transferring kilowatt hours miles and miles away. So they really benefit from small solar arrays all over the place. It keeps their grid more levelized.
It does seem kind of counterintuitive to what Governor Reynolds has said about promoting alternative energy in the state, because it sounds like this is going to cost people around $300 if they do have these solar panels and they're tied in with the energy providers.
It's kind of ridiculous, you know, especially with our state being seen as such a large renewable energy state with wind. Now, that's like an average number, I believe. It's just kind of based on, like, I'm not sure exactly how it was figured, but I've heard the number about $300 a year on average, because basically they're just going to assess a charge to people that have solar because they think they're not paying their fair share of the maintenance needs and stuff for the grid.
It sounds like people who buy the solar panels and use the solar power are still very much tied up to the grid.
Very few people have cut the cord and been disconnected from the grid. That involves batteries and much more expensive inverters and very complicated, complex systems that people want to stay away from. So they stay tied to the grid. So at night and on bad Sundays, they're just, all right, I'll buy it for today. But when the sun's out, they're just going to offset as much as they can.
This bill has already passed a committee. Looks like it's going to go to the floor for a vote. What is your outlook now?
So I think they really are showing favoritism to big industry like utilities. And investor-owned utilities, and they're not really paying attention to the job creation and the dollar savings on the ground floor to the citizens of Iowa. They're really overlooking that, no matter how much we ring the bell and show them that. It's really disheartening to us because, again, we're very proud to be in the renewable energy. I used to be in robotics a long time ago. I changed careers just because I wanted to stop taking people's jobs and start, you know, saving the planet. I'm a little bit of a tree hugger. You can't tell.
That was Logan Welch, a renewable energy product manager and solar specialist for Van Meter Electrical Supply in Webster City. He's been lobbying against a bill that would charge an additional fee to customers who use solar panels, and that bill is now going on to the full House. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. On this Ash Wednesday, Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer takes a closer look at the religious holiday. She spoke recently with Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at Morningside College, Dr. Bruce Forbes, on that subject.
You first have to say what is Easter, then you have to say what is Lent, and then you have to say what is Ash Wednesday, because they all build on each other. So, of course, Easter, when we talk about the two most popular Christian celebrations of the year, we think of Christmas and Easter. Easter really theologically is most important because it's about the death and the resurrection of Jesus. So early on in Christianity, it used to be every Sunday was a little Easter. And then they decided, let's have a great big annual celebration. That's Easter as we know it. And let's have a time of preparation, really spiritual preparation leading up to it, which is 40 days prior to Easter, where Christians would go through self-examination and all the rest. And that is considered a very important spiritual time.
And that's Lent.
That's Lent. By the way, I was just looking this up the other day. Where did we get that word? It comes from the Old English that really means spring. And I have a whole set of theories about holidays and so on, that they're linked to seasonal festivals, and this is another one, but we won't get into that now. So Ash Wednesday is the beginning of Lent. It's the first day, and it's I think it's really good to have symbolic transitions when you move from one phase to another. I mean, it's the reason you have weddings. You could just move in, but...
Well, some people do.
Yeah, some people do. But you could, I mean, to go through some kind of ceremony or something helps you kind of reset your mind. And so I think Ash Wednesday is this special day where, I mean, what people usually, it can be a full service, but people usually think of ashes put on the
forehead.
And
where did that get started?
Well, it really comes out of a long Jewish tradition. What Ash Wednesday is supposed to be about is a reminder of our mortality and a time of kind of repentance and self-reflection. And there's a long tradition of ashes. Haven't we heard the phrase sackcloth and ashes when people are mourning or whatever? That's a Jewish tradition that carries over into Christianity. It reminds us that we are dust and to dust will we will return, and that we're human beings and that we're fallible. Some people say that's a real downer.
I was going to say, yeah. Yes.
But although that's another issue, because some people, I think a lot of, there's some Christianity now where you should always just feel good. You probably want to, isn't Christianity about more than just feeling good? And I think this is, if you don't want to talk about it in that negative way, it's still a time for self-reflection, examination about the purpose and of my life, how I want to reorient it if I do. I mean, we probably should have times like that, and that's what this is for.
Bringing you back to earth.
Yes.
Literally.
Realistic.
Yes. What are the ashes made out of?
The tradition in most places is that the palms from Palm Sunday in the previous year are burned, and then they become the ashes, and they're used for the ashes then.
I know, growing up Catholic, that was always a big thing. And I always just thought, hey, that's just what the Catholics do, but that's not true.
No, that's a good point. We sometimes talk about high church and low church in terms of Christianity. High church would be the more ritualized traditions, smells and bells, pageants, all the rest. And that would be Catholic and Episcopalian and Lutheran, etc. Then we talk about low church, very informal, not much structure to the services. They usually don't do this. And then you have some Protestant denominations that are kind of in between, let's say like Methodist and Presbyterian. They sometimes do and sometimes don't, depends on the church. But yeah, it's not just Catholics. It's certainly high church Christians and some in the middle range. A lot of people do it.
And they're doing the drive-through ashes to go?
I think even though you can have a full service, it's really the marking of the forehead that's the sign. And some people, I guess, with busy lives, don't feel like they have a time for a whole service. So a number of different churches have come. I used to teach at Morningside College. They would be in the commons, you know, before people are having lunch and have ashes available. Or chapels, you know, in the morning, you can just come, get the ashes, and leave.
And my mom would say, don't wash them off. Don't touch they're supposed to wear off naturally.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true, but that's what she used to tell me.
Well, yeah, I think that's stronger in the Catholic tradition than others,
yeah.
I think, yes.
I did take one of your religion classes at Morningside, and you did open my eyes to a lot about religion. There was more than just what I grew up with.
And
I think my mom didn't like that.
I do think it's one of the goals, at least for us in religious studies, it's not to kind of change people's beliefs or whatever, but it is to widen our world. And in this world, globalization, you know, we're just aware of not just other forms of Christianity, but other religions around the world. We're not going to get along unless we understand each other. The other thing that, by the way, we have interesting discussions about among Christians, Lent is 40 days. However, if you go from Ash Wednesday to Easter and count those days on the calendar, it's more than 40 days. What's the reason? It's because Sundays don't count. Because as I said before, every Sunday is kind of a little Easter. And so if you're giving up things for Lent, there's a discussion about, does that mean if I gave up chocolate for Lent, I really can still have chocolate on Sunday? And some people would say yes, and some people would no. It depends on the tradition.
Jesus, refuge of the weary, blessed Redeemer, whom we love, fountain in life's desert.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Lying beneath the snow, deep below the frozen ground, are the roots of the prairie. The grasses that once spread as far as the eye could see evolved to wait out these cold Midwestern winters, which is a good lesson. Jim Skop takes us back to those prairies today.
Baby steps in prairie grass. It took me 31 years of Iowa living to take my first steps on real native prairie, the kind my great-grandparents must have set upon when they arrived in northwest Iowa in the 1880s. 31 years seems like a lifetime. But then real native prairie goes at a premium in this corner of the state. You can stumble on a few slope patches of original grasses along the bluffs of the Big Sioux, but for decades already, the land has been drawn and quartered by endless row crops of a gigantic garden. I'm told that, topographically speaking, the state of Iowa is home to the most fully transformed ecosystem of any of the 50 states. The forever grassy landscape that grabbed Lewis and Clark's breath the moment they set their eyes on it once used to shiver in the wind like cat fur. Today, Sioux County, where I live, is the most altered county of any of Iowa's 99. 50 years ago, Sioux County people would have boasted about how good Dutch folks drained out sloughs and creeks and put all this land into production. We'd have sung a hymn of triumph. Today, that song would sound more like a dirge. Isn't it wonderful to know there's absolutely nothing left of what was, is a question that answers itself. But let me describe those baby steps, my first on native prairie. Dawn came bewitchingly. Thick summer haze lay like a mystical gossamer river through the land's low spots, casting everything in mellow gold. I stopped beside a 140-acre piece of land called Steel Prairie State Preserve. It's not far away. Those acres look entirely unmanaged. Wild sedge meadow and marsh vegetation answering to no one. A chaotic Iowa caucus of plant life. I know good people who wouldn't find Steel Prairie Preserve at all attractive. But my first steps on native prairie created a whole different feel than what's beneath you when you walk on cropland. Native grasses aren't spindly or scattered. In a half dozen steps, my shoes were wet, pant legs soaked, and I had a whole new sense of prairie schooners slugging through the heavy grasses on bumpy land that hadn't been plowed and dissed and planted and harrowed, but was instead a huge natural mess. You can turn an ankle in a minute at Steel Prairie. I had to slog my way through the thick shagginess, a knee-high jungle. But not until you stand there can you imagine the sheer wealth of what has been stripped away. Now, I didn't grow up on a farm. I don't know the earth out here the intimate way my father-in-law came to know it through 70 years of seed time and harvest. 50 years ago, if I had lived here on that Saturday morning I watched the sunrise at Steel Prairie, I wouldn't have been out there. I'd have been inside a barn milking cows. But the morning I walked through the Museum of Native Plant Life that is Steel Prairie, I couldn't help but think that out here in the bountiful northwest corner of the state, we'd live better if we were capable of giving something back to what so beautifully was by divesting some corn and soybeans, shutting down at least some of what we've done. It would be great here to have more prairie, to see more of the tall grass. Really, it's what we owe the land. If our kids could on some Saturday morning take a long walk in restored prairie and look over, say, miles of the great ocean of grass that once was here, wouldn't we all treasure more of what we have? Wouldn't it be great if, in the wide expanse of rolling prairie in a faraway corner of the state, we'd all just try a few baby steps towards more fully remembering and honoring what once was right here beneath our feet? ¶¶
Support for Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media comes from the Daniels Osborne Law Firm in the Ho-Chunk Center in downtown Sioux City, serving the needs of clients in real estate transactions, business formation and guidance, and personal estate planning. More information is available on Facebook or at danielsosborne.com. You've been listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. Be sure to join us on March 20th at the Sioux City Public Library. We'll have a live discussion on the effects of the tariff war. We'll talk to farmers, manufacturers, and local experts on international trade. The program will be broadcast live from the Gleason Room at the Public Library at noon, or you are welcome to join us there live. That's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer and Bruce Forbes. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.